This week, we're looking at development, talking to Jeff Perlman, CEO and founder of Real Software.
My Mac Podcast 170.
The next generation of radio. It's the MyMac.com podcast.
And as Guy said at the top of the show, this is My Mac Podcast number 170, the 170th weekly podcast that we've done, and joined today by David Cohen, all the way from the UK. Hello, David.
Good evening.
And Guy Searle, he's in the
state of madness.
Yeah, I was just going to say, where are you, Guy? Are you healthy now?
No,
I mean,
no, I'm still not healthy. I'm so sick.
You actually missed a couple days of work this week, I understand.
Yeah, I went into work on Monday and stayed for about 5 minutes, just long enough to make sure that my kids weren't going to call me to tell me that they had to come home. And then I split as fast as I could and basically spent Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday in bed with like 102 fever.
Oh, that sounds like a lot of fun.
No, it wasn't. But at least there wasn't the Technicolor splendor that my son Guy exhibited during his bout of sickness.
Oh, always fun.
Yeah.
So later in the show, we're going to have the interview with CEO and founder of Real Software, Jeff Perlman. Fascinating guy. I don't know anything about programming. After we did the interview, I actually feel like I know something about programming at this point. Let's start off, though. I got a few things that I'm going to be reviewing here in the near future, and I kind of wanted to get my initial impressions and to ask if you guys are doing any product reviews at the moment. Anything you guys got on your plate that you're looking at here in the near future?
Yeah, I mean, there's a pile of stuff come through. I've just received a couple of drives from Seagate. I've got the Seagate Free Agent Pro, which is at my desk at the moment, which I'm actually quite impressed with. It looks like quite a nice 1 terabyte desktop drive.
Can you believe we're using 1 terabyte drives nowadays?
It's insane.
We don't even act like it's a big deal anymore. It's a terabyte.
I know. We're talking about programming and development this week. I mean, the first programs I wrote, I used to store on audio tape. You used to tape recorder inside your computer and store
them. It seems crazy to me that we're using such big drives that we actually need this much storage space, but we do.
Well, I'm actually waiting for the petabyte iPhone.
You're going to be waiting a while, I think.
Yeah, that's right. That's
a ways off.
Yeah, so I'm looking at those. I've got a speaker set from Gear 4, who we saw at Macworld on review at the moment. I'll be writing the review up probably in the next couple of weeks. And that's a Bluetooth speaker set with a Bluetooth dongle that goes in the iPod. So that's quite interesting.
Initial impressions, positive, negative? Somewhere in the middle?
Yeah, the speaker unit actually looks fantastic. It has it's got a backlit display. It kind of has an LED display that looks like something out of the 80s. So it has this sort of really cool retro look to it. In terms of sound, the speakers sound pretty decent. Though when you're using Bluetooth, you do suffer a bit on the quality. And if you're listening to vocal stuff like podcasts, it can sometimes sound a bit boomy. But generally, it's a pretty nice set of speakers. I'm reasonably impressed with it.
Any other things that you got on the plate coming up soon?
Yeah, I'm just trying to. Talking of drives as well. I've been speaking to Drobo. I did the Drobo review probably 2-3 months ago, and they've got a network attached storage option that sort of adds on to the Drobo to turn it into a network device. So that should be on the way to me in the next month or so. So that should be quite good.
Larry Grinnell, Guy Searle's brother, just did a review of a NAS. It's from Phantom Drives. Gave it a 1 out of 5.
I mean,
it doesn't get any lower than that, and he wasn't real pleased with it. He even sent a email to the PR guy from the company themselves and said, you know, I really wanted to like this program or this hard drive, and I can attest to that because Larry is really a NAS man. And,
there comes the explicit tag.
There it is. No, I said NAS.
Oh, okay.
NAS. And, you know, we got to keep it real. If something isn't as good as you were hoping or as it should be or that it's advertised, we have to keep it real, just like real software. You see how I did that? Mm-hmm. That was I got to give myself credit for that.
That was smooth.
And a 1 out of 5, I think people, as much as we like to give a high score to a product, software, hardware, whatever,
it's got to be good.
If it's a great product, we want to share that with our listeners, with our readers, with whatever. But if it's a bad product, I think it's just as important to share that information as well. So thanks very much to Larry for the review of the Phantom Drive GeForce Mega Disk NAS. 1 out of 5. That's not too good. But I still recommend everybody go up there and read it. Go up to the MyMac.com site. It's on the feature side. What do you got coming up, Guy? Any reviews, or are you kind of in between products at the moment?
I don't actually have anything coming in for review. I'm still trying to get like these last anywhere from 2 to 4 iWeb articles out. The one I'm working on right now is starting to get a little lengthy, and I'm trying to decide whether to break it up into more than one. Probably over the next week or so, I'll be sending that to you. One more of the iWeb articles talking about blogs.
Yeah, did the recent update to iWeb make any changes to the program that were significant enough to warrant inclusion in any articles?
Not that I saw. I haven't seen any real change in the functionality, which is what I'm really dealing with.
Yeah. For myself, I've got a lot of products sitting here. The one that I'm using right now is a pair of JBL headphones, the Reference 510s. They're nice. They got the nice noise cancellation feature that you turn on. The one that I've been using for forever is a old pair of Sennheiser that has noise cancellation, and I really like those. And so that's always been my reference, if you will, when I compare other noise cancellation headphones. And so far, the JBL sound pretty good. And this is still early in the review. I've used them for maybe 3 or 4 days. So, I mean, it's very early, and you have to let anything like speakers break in over a period of time, especially headphones.
But they're not wireless, are they?
No, they're not wireless. And they're not the ones that we used at the Blades Shaw concert.
Right.
Yep. But that being said, they're very comfortable. They really squeeze your head. These are over-the-ear headphones. These are not earbuds. I hate earbuds, by the way. I don't really like to use earbuds at all. So John Nemo is going to be doing the earbud headphone reviews, and I think I'll be doing the over-the-ear reviews from now on.
Oh, shucks.
But one of the things that I've noticed about these so far is when you turn on the noise cancellation, rather than it literally canceling out at least a majority of the ambient
noise.
Sound around you, it's introducing this hissing sound. And
so it's more like just replacing one sound with another.
It's introducing white noise, and that's not really the same thing as canceling the other noises. And I don't get that from the Sennheisers that I use.
Yeah, it could be a problem with the technology they're actually using to noise cancel. Sometimes if it gets it wrong, you can hear some hiss. So
it's really pronounced too, especially with music that's not. You know, classical music in soft passages, really, really notice. Or slow songs, you really notice it. But in rock, AC/DC or Metallica, you're not going to hear anything.
And when you take them off, you still don't hear anything.
Right. And these are $150 headphones, so I'm a little bit disappointed to begin with after a couple days. But again, it's still new. I'm going to replace the battery that's in here, although it's my battery. It didn't ship with one, which kind of ticked me off. If your product needs a battery,
the least
you can do is put a battery in there. Especially if it's going to be a gift. I mean, someone opens this, all right, and oh, crap, now I got to go buy a battery because it doesn't even come with one.
Yeah.
That's kind of cheap. I don't like that. But so far, I'm not a big fan so far, but I'm going to keep using them. We'll see what happens. The other two products that I've got are both from iHome. Now, this is a company that we don't have any kind of a relationship with. We've never done any of their product reviews before, as far as I know. We're working with DrBot.com. Great website, by the way. They sell a lot of stuff. Mm. And DrBot is actually the company that sent the headphones and the speakers for our review.
Right.
And I've got the iHome IH14D Deluxe Table AM/FM radio for iPod. And it's got a wood finish on it.
Wow.
And you can actually smell the wood. It's only got one speaker, so it's mono. But so far, I'm kind of impressed with it. I mean, you're not going to get high fidelity sound out of it.
Well, you wouldn't for a product like that. It's not really what it's meant
for. But it's a $50 bookshelf speaker, and it actually lays sideways. You would expect a speaker to sit up. This actually lays sideways, and the big control knobs, it's got two knobs that control, one's for volume and one's for switching from the iPod to the radio or to an auxiliary input. And then there's this huge knob on the right side of it. And that controls the frequency for the radio.
You kind of going
so
for
far,
that,
I'm quite impressed.
They're kind of going for that old school, like, you know, Valve wireless look with the wood and the big knobs on there, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. If you go up to, well, if you do a product search real quick on Google while we're talking for the IH14D,
yeah,
you'll see exactly what it looks like. It's a neat looking device. It's not big at all.
Yeah.
But surprisingly, it sounds a lot better than I was expecting it. And the other thing that I'm really not going to review this myself, the idea of getting this product, and it's another one from the iHome factory, it's the IH8, number 8, PR. This is literally a clock radio.
Yeah, I've seen those.
Yeah, but this one's pink. So I gave this to our 13-year-old daughter, and I said, play with this for a while, and in a week or two, I'm going to sit you down in the front of the microphone for the podcast, not while we're actually recording the podcast. I'll do it separately. And I'll talk to you about this iPod player. I want you to tell me how it works. Do you like it? And, of course, this is $100, $99.99 is the price up at Dr. Bot. The first thing that she did when she opened it, she's got two other iPod speaker systems. The first thing that she did when she opened it, she went, cool. I said, now, do you like that so far? And she was like, oh, yeah. I said, why do you like it? What's the thing that grabs you the most? It's pink. Never underestimate the color pink. That's all I'm saying. So those are the three products that I've been looking at.
She's not been talking about getting a pink Nano.
No, she's actually got a silver iPod Nano. Did I tell you guys that story at all?
No, I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
Well, she had had a shuffle.
Right.
Both my older daughters had shuffles. They got them for Christmas 2 years ago. And Brittany is who we're talking about right now. Her first shuffle died. And this wasn't the first generation shuffle. This was the second generation.
Right.
One gigahertz iPod shuffle. It died, so she got another one. That's working fine, except it just didn't have enough space on it. She's really, really getting into music now. For her birthday and Christmas, she wanted, like, iTunes music cards.
Wow.
So she can buy her own music. Yeah. Of course, it's all in my library.
Of course.
So, you know, I get to hear all the crap that she buys. And so music is really becoming real, real important to her. See, I'm using the term real more. More real good segue for the interviews later.
Yeah, it's real annoying. But go ahead.
It's real annoying. she really wanted a more space on her music player. So I said, well, you know, the Nano start at $150.
Yeah.
But I told her, I said, I'm not buying you one. So she literally saved up her money. And when I say her money, I'm not talking about bills for the most part. I'm talking about quarters. If she did something, we'd give her a quarter for it, or, you know, whatever it was, she got quarters, dimes, nickels, pennies, you name it. And there's some ones and fives in there, don't get me wrong. But she saved up her money, and she's been saving it for like 6 months.
Wow.
Wow.
Finally, she tells me that she thinks she's got enough. So I said, okay, let's you know, count it up, see what you got. She had like $60 in bills, and the rest were all change.
Oh, my God.
This is on a Saturday around 3 o'clock. Too late to go to a bank to get cash for the change. So I said, well, you know, we can either wait till Monday or you can buy it with your change. And she says, can I do that? I said, oh, of course, it's money. So she has a shoebox and it's full of this change and it's very heavy. Oh. And I'm not kidding, it was heavy. So we go to Best Buy and she picks out the Nano that she wants.
Oh, they hated you.
There's this big line that we get in the big line. She gets up there. And the cashier says, oh, that last customer. And I'd seen that this guy had had the same customer for a while. The other cashiers went through three or four people in the same amount of time. I said, well, if that was a pain in the butt, wait till you get to us. And he was like, oh, no, there's nothing you guys can do that with that.
You don't know me very well, do ye?
So Brittany pulls out this box and opens it up. And there's all this change in there. And, of course, it's not separated. And his eyes just about bugged out of his head. It was so funny. Now, a lot of the people that were in line behind us were upset because they're waiting. But I kept explaining as the line's moving through that she's 13. She saved all this money up on her own to buy her own iPod. And everybody's attitude changed. They were like, oh, wow, good for her. That's cool.
Yeah.
And so she bought her own iPod Nano with her own money.
How much did she have?
And most of it was
quarters.
Well, it was $150 Nano, so she had $60 in cash. So, you know, the rest of it was all change.
And she used up pretty much everything she had?
No, she still had a couple of dimes and pennies left, and nickels. But most of it was quarters, believe it or not.
Well, if she hadn't had enough, were you going to run up the difference?
Absolutely not. She said she knew she had enough in there. And so I took her word for it. I didn't count it. We just went there. And if she didn't have enough, that she was going to have to live with that embarrassment. And I thought that was fair. You know, if you're going to save your money and you say you have enough and we're going to go to the store, you better have enough.
Yeah.
And she was confident, so we went. And she owns her own iPod Nano at this point.
Which one did she get?
She got the silver one.
Okay, that's right. You said
Sorry. Yeah, it has to be. The other ones that are with color on there, I think they're black. And there's all different kinds of pink one now. Those are $199.
Yeah, the 8
Now, she would have liked one of those. Right.
Yeah.
That would have been another $50 and probably five more shoe boxes. So she went with the silver one. And quite honestly, I think she's got it three-quarters of the way full. But that's with a movie on there. She actually rented or she had bought Pirates of the Caribbean movie, and she put that on.
Ooh, that's like almost half of it right there, I bet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like 900 megs.
Yeah.
So I thought it was interesting. I like to share that. It's a 13-year-old saving up her money and buying an iPod.
Yeah, my kids are actually supposedly saving up their money right now to buy a Wii, because I refuse to buy them yet another game system. They already have a GameCube and a PS2. And it's like, no. You know, you guys got enough going on. You haven't finished half the games you already own.
Oh, don't do that. I hear people, oh, you never finish the games you got. Why am I going to buy a new one? I hate that. You can't use that. That's ugh.
Bad. The thing with the Wii is once you get it in the house, it's like crack. You just can't stop using it.
Well, as someone who's got all three of the new platforms, PS3, Xbox 360, and the Wii, I can tell you that the Wii gets the least amount of game time from me or anybody in the family.
Yeah, they keep talking about the Xbox 360, but it's like...
That's where the best games
are. Yeah, and you're probably right, but the problem is that they already have a bunch of GameCube games, which they can play in the Wii, and they have a bunch of PS2 games that they can play, most of them anyway, in the PS3. It's like, I'm not going
no,
to...
No, they can't.
Oh, most of the PS2 games won't play in the PS3?
Well, the first generation of PS3s, you could, but Sony took away backwards compatibility out of the new PS3s. And most people don't know that, which is a very nice thing. But here's the thing, guy. They already got a PS2 and a GameCube, so they don't need the Wii or a PS3 to play those. They can play them on the old systems.
But, you know, my whole thing is I'm not going to have three different game systems sitting there, you know, connected up to this TV set.
Right,
it's
but once they
enough,
get...
There's like, two.
Right, but if they did get a Xbox 360, I guarantee you they're not going to want to play the older games because the new ones are so much better. But anyways, this isn't the video game podcast. Let's get back to the Mac stuff. One of the things that let's cover what's going on up at mymac.com, and then we'll get into our discussion about software on the Macintosh a little bit. Like I said, Larry Grinnell did the review of the NAS. David Weeks did a review of and gave it a 5 out of 5. Total Leopard Super Guidebook from Macworld magazine. I know they were very pleased with that review score. I saw their comments come back on that, so they were very happy. Donnie Ankelo did Return of the Downloads, and it's been a while since he did any Macspirations recommending downloads, and this is another one. It's definitely worth checking out. What else is up there, guys? Oh, we got a new writer.
Yeah.
Gil Polson. Yep, Gil Polson is a brand new writer at mymac.com. Robert Hazelrig, who contributes a lot to the podcast in the past, has a tendency to send out emails to I don't know how he decides who gets these emails, and he's talking about, you know, this on the Mac platform or that or Apple in general or whatever, his predictions for Macworld, that sort of thing. And one of the people on that email list was me, of course, but was also Gil Polson. And I've read a few of his replies to Robert that he replied to the entire group that Robert had sent the question out to. And his answers always seem to be well thought out, and as far as I was concerned, right on the money most of the time. So I did a search for him on the internet, and I found his blog, which hadn't been updated in over a year. But for what was up there, it was well written. So I thought, wow, this guy seems to have some ability. So I sent him an email asking him to submit something and join MyMac.com, and he did. So I'm real happy. And he did a review of CrashPlan. It's an off-site backup solution, which looks pretty cool to me.
Mm. Yep. Larry did a Adobe Type Library reference book preview.
Which I thought was kind of crazy because really it's a catalog of the contents of a CD-ROM.
Right.
And it goes for $45. Now, coming from a design background like I do, I understand why that's needed. But, man, $50 for a book about type? Yikes. And that's kind of expensive.
And you might almost think that, you know, hey, this is an advertisement because the guys that might buy this book are also going to need to go out and buy the fonts.
Absolutely.
So give them the damn book, you know?
Up on the blog side, I've posted a lot of blogs the last couple of days. Go back a little bit. Adobe Kill stock photo royalty-free image service. I was kind of surprised to see that come through, that Adobe is no longer going to have their stock photos up there anymore. You're not going to be able to buy these royalty-free images from Adobe. I don't know why they did that, I guess.
Yes, I mean, obviously a service like that must cost them a fair amount of money, and it's interesting. I think everybody's starting to... you know, with the economic situation that's developing, people are starting to look at their you know, their outgoings on a corporate basis and say, is this somewhere where we can make some savings, maybe?
Well, I also think that iStock Photo, which are not an advertiser here, I think they're eating probably, but I know that they're eating everybody's lunch in that category. So I think Adobe just saw the writing on the wall and said, why are we going to keep throwing good money at a bad product when it's not doing for us what we want it to do? So maybe it's not so surprising, you know. A really good service like iStock Photo comes along, the prices are better, they got a huge library, it's all user-contributed stuff. Why not?
And they share the wealth.
They do share the wealth. If I was a photographer, that's the place that I would definitely be looking at. I posted this video, it's called Freeze Time.
Yeah, I saw that.
Did you guys see that video? I thought that was so cool. Mm. Did you see that, David?
Yeah, I saw it.
I'm not into performance art. That's not my thing at all.
You could just see people were just freaking out that they were just standing there like statues.
What happened was it was Grand Central Station, correct?
Yeah, in New York.
Yeah, and a whole like 200 people at exactly the same time, whatever they were doing, would just freeze. Yeah,
didn't they time that with like a cell phone or something like that? That was the
or
signal.
Something. Everybody just froze.
This is the phenomenon is called the flash mob, isn't it? Where they organize it via Twitter or via SMS, and then they get all these people together to do something weird. We've had a couple of these in Britain where people have. We had one a couple of years ago in Liverpool Street Station where about 500 people turned up and started dancing just for 2 minutes and then disappeared again.
Didn't they do that with like their each one had like an iPod and was listening to their own music?
That's right, yeah.
I remember that.
You watch this video and you can see people just trying to figure it out, you know, like what's going on. You know,
I think those things are neat. I really do.
Yeah.
Because nobody can hear the music that they're dancing to except the people that are dancing.
That's right, yeah.
Right. So you got all these people in a busy train station in the middle of London just, you know, trying to get wherever the heck it is they're trying to go to. And there are these people just, you know, jumping and jiving all over the place.
Crazy stuff. The other video that I posted up there in the same kind of category was from Sean Levin. He sent me this link for his YouTube video that he posted, and it's of the Shaw Blades concert. It's actually the day before that we went, Guy. It's not the same one that we were at.
I didn't think so.
Because he showed the front row and we're not sitting there.
That's what gave it away. I didn't know they'd done more than one.
Yeah, they did two shows. They did the day before and then the day we went, so Wednesday and Thursday.
Okay.
And so if anybody – we keep talking about the Shaw Blades concert that we thought it was really cool. You can get kind of a taste for it. Obviously, you're hearing the acoustics. You're not hearing it what it sounded like through the headphones, which is
a thousand times better.
Yeah. But it's still – you'll see how close that you really were sitting to these guys, and it was really interesting. So take a look at that up at the blog site. It's Shaw Blades JBL Tour. By the way, if I sound a little different, it's because there's no heat in my basement, and it's really freaking cold down here right now. So that's why I'm like, David Cohen has posted 16 and 32 gigabytes. Let the whining begin. What's that about, David?
Well, this was when the this was Tuesday when the iPods and the iPhone were updated, and I just knew, and sure enough, I did see the whining start straight away. This seems to be a real thing at the moment, that it doesn't matter what Apple do, there's a very vocal minority who just immediately starts saying, oh, it's not right, it's not good enough. We've had it for the last 3 weeks with the MacBook Air. You know, and the MacBook Air, I appreciate, is not for everybody, but you know, you can't deny it's a bold, innovative product, and this is what we like Apple for. And yet, it's been getting pretty much very, very negative coverage. And I just as well knew that as soon as they updated the iPhone and the iPod Touch, that people would start complaining. And sure enough, within half an hour of the announcement, it's interesting for me because I'm over here in England. I see this as soon as it hits because it's the middle of my day here, when in fact it's still early morning over for you guys. And literally within half an hour of the Apple Store coming back up, I was seeing posts around the net of people saying, oh, I can't believe that they've added more memory and yet they haven't dropped the price, and all of these
copy paste and blah, blah, blah.
And then there was somebody saying, oh, 32 gigabyte for an iPod Touch, that's still not enough, it needs to be at least 64 gigabytes before I even think about it. And it's just like,
but they're not willing to they're not willing to spend $1,000 extra.
Exactly.
For it,
though, that was another one. There was some guy who was going, how come they can give an extra 8 gigabyte for $100 and yet they want $1,000 for a 64 gigabyte SSD in the MacBook Air? And it's just like we in some ways the community almost parodies itself. I mean, you know, people don't need to take the mickey out of it because there some guy somewhere who.
But isn't that true for almost any kind of fan base like this?
Well, probably.
It's not just, you know, I'm sure the pro wrestling fans have the same bitches and complaints. I know that the NFL fans do. Car hobbyists have complaints like this. I mean, I think that's pretty much true in any industry.
A lot of sad people in New England right now.
I think as a human race, we just like to complain anyway.
We do not. I resent that.
Bill Palmer actually had a post that kind of related to it as well. Bill Palmer, of course, of iProng magazine. He says his post is titled, "Didn't think I'd care about a 16 gigabyte iPhone, but..." And I'll let you guys figure out what the butt means. Go check that out up at mymac.com on the blog side. I posted two videos from our trip to the Macworld Expo, one for the Lentex booth and one for the Crumpler. Crumpler, of course, is the backpacks and the carrying bags for your computer and stuff like that.
That booth was amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was really odd.
it was
quirky,
let's
put it that way.
Yeah. Just a visit to their website is a bit like an acid trip, really. And their booth was like a little cardboard city in the middle of the expo. It really was quite interesting. I like them anyway because they have a band called the Tony Blair. I think if it
just goes along with you no matter where you go.
I just like the idea of opening up my Tony Blair and shoving something into it.
I like it how I said it better. It just kind of goes with the flow.
That's right.
And it doesn't complain. Well, we're going to keep our segment short this week, guys, because we've got a really interesting interview that we did with Jeff Perlman, CEO of Real Software.
He's a great guy.
He was a really great guy, and it was a lot of fun talking to him. Next week, and I say this at the end of the show as well, we do not have a guest next week.
That we know
it. At least nobody official yet. But it is going to be Valentine's Day when we record it, so we're going to have much love for the Mac.
Oh, Tim.
And, Macintosh, we love you. And the week after that, we got AOL coming up. So, David, thanks much for staying up late over there on the for me, it's the East Coast time zone.
Yeah.
It's the same for Guy. What is that over there? Is it mean time for you guys?
Greenwich mean time at the moment, and then we switch to British summertime in the summer. So, but it's Greenwich mean time at the moment.
BST.
BST, yeah, for the summertime.
So let's jump over. We've got a few things to – I got a promo. I'm going to play that real quick, and then we'll jump right to the Jeff Perlman interview.
MyMac.com produces some of the best Mac-related podcasts out there. It made me a switcher. As an earth science teacher, I decided to take some of the knowledge that Tim and the rest of the MyMac crew produces for us each week and made a podcast devoted to all things earth science. I hope to give you some insights into just what it is that makes the world around us tick with a little pod-safe music thrown in to boot. So if you're interested in volcanoes, earthquakes, the weather, or even astronomy, check the iTunes store for Let's Get Down to Earth Science, or go to cvscience.wordpress.com.
And we're back, and on the line with us today is Jeff Perlman. He's the CEO of Real Software. Hi, Jeff.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you in Austin, Texas?
Well, Austin's great. We have beautiful weather this time of year, unlike, say, the middle of July when it's horrible.
Yeah, no, that's not a place I'd want to be in the middle of July. It gets a little bit too stuffy down there for me. It's not good for my skin. Not to say that the freezing cold snow that we have here in Michigan is any better, but
yeah, that does wonderful things for your skin, Tim.
It sure does. So, Jeff, you're the CEO. Any other titles? President or
founder and CEO? Yeah,
founder and CEO.
President,
of Real Software.
Janitor. You know,
whatever needs to be done, that's what
right.
Jeff's doing.
That's right.
Now, I have to be completely honest. I'm not a programmer, Jeff. I've always kind of wanted
that
to.
You.
Yeah, I've always wanted to be, but it just scares the crap out of me, to be honest. It looks like a lot of work, and I just don't know what I'm doing, so I've always kind of avoided it.
Well, I'll tell you that we have a lot of customers. First of all, our customers, our users, are really they run the gamut. So we have some people that have never done any programming before in their lives, other people that have been programming for 30 years, and everybody in between. But of those that had never done any programming before, they just had an idea. You know, they had something they wanted to do, and they thought maybe Real Basic would be a way to get started. And, you know, one example is this guy who worked – he was a scanner operator at a printing company, and he had an idea for some software that would save the company money. So he never done any programming before. He learned Real Basic and built this application. And it saved the company so much money that they decided that they could make money selling the software to other printers. And they put him in charge of a software division. So we have stories like that where, you know, people that have never done any programming before are just getting started with Real Basic.
Let's go back in time a little bit and say my first question to you, Jeff, is where you grew up. Where did you grow up at? Was it there in Austin, or are you a transplant?
No, I'm a transplant. I grew up in Orange County, California, in Irvine, and as I like to say, behind the orange curtain.
Yeah.
And grew up there and moved to Silicon Valley when I was about 25 to take a job. Sure.
Right in the mecca of it, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And I was there for about 4 years and decided that most of my life I've worked for myself. I decided I wanted to go back to doing that. And a friend of mine was moving to Austin, and having lived in California all my life, I decided, well, let's try something new and see how it goes. And that was in 1994. So
wow.
I've been here ever since.
So what was your first Macintosh?
My first Macintosh was a Mac, let's see, it was a 512KE.
Wow.
I wanted to get a Lisa, but at the time I couldn't get my dad to cough up the $10,000. But when I saw the Lisa, I immediately knew that this was the future of computing. And that's why I desperately wanted one, but like I said, they were just too expensive. And my dad said, anyway, I hear that there's this Mac thing coming out. So waited for that.
Was your dad into computers as well?
Yeah, my dad was an engineer at Rockwell International, and I wouldn't say he was into computers. How do I put this?
Was
my
a computer.
Well, yeah. When you talk to him, you might think that. Math, I think my dad speaks about math better than English, but he... My dad really didn't want to be an engineer. My grandfather basically told him that if he wanted him to pay for college, he was going to be an engineer.
One of those, yeah.
Yeah, so, and you have to understand, his older brothers both worked on the atomic bomb, so there was a lot of
sibling rivalry?
Well, not really sibling rivalry, but yeah, pressure, definitely. And You know, my dad, for example, with a master's degree in engineering, has the least amount of education of anyone in his family.
Wow, that's saying something.
Yeah, so he was into computers a little bit. He got me into computers. My dad brought home – I'm going to really date myself now. My dad brought home a Texas Instruments portable terminal. This thing had no screen, just a thermal printer and acoustic couplers for the phone. And we would dial into the mainframe and write little programs in, you know, the original BASIC language. Matter of fact, they also had the original adventure game, Texas
sure.
Adventure. And
wow.
That's kind of what got me into computers. And I have to say, and this is going to sound really geeky, but I got into computers because I was a huge fan of Star Trek. And
no, that's not surprising. A lot of people did back.
Yeah. And,
well, I'm almost 40. I'm putting you at probably around the same age as I am.
Yeah, I'm 44.
Okay, so yeah, you're around the same age group. So a lot of the people in our age grew up with Star Trek, with Star Wars, and,
yeah.
and that type of technology. We saw what was possible, and then we saw what the reality was, and
yeah,
a lot of people kind of went from there.
Yeah, and computers for me were just the closest thing I could get to Star Trek, you know? So I had we worked with this portable terminal, then... I couldn't convince my dad to buy an Apple II because he said, "Oh, you're just paying for the brand name." so we got an Ace, a Franklin Ace 1000, which was an Apple II clone, and that thing broke so many times. I'm sure my dad paid way more than he would have ever paid for the Apple II.
For the original.
Yeah.
Right. So, So I got into programming in BASIC on the mainframe, and then on the Apple II, and then. I programmed in a lot of different environments until Real Basic came along.
Why did you get into programming?
Why did I get into programming? I guess, you know, that's a really good question. I guess I got into programming because it was a way to control the computer. It was like, you know, probably the equivalent of why kids play video games these days. It's like it was this other world. And, you know, you're 10 years old. How much control do you have over anything, right?
And really, at the time, there wasn't much to do on the computer if you're not programming with it.
Right. So it was just a way for me to have a world that I could dominate, you know. It was my evil empire or something like that.
Yeah.
I think that's what got me into it originally.
So where did Cross Basic come from? Talk to us about that a little bit.
Okay, so...
I know, because that kind of got you into where we're at now.
Yeah, Cross Basic was the predecessor to Real Basic. Basically, no pun intended, I was a big fan of Visual Basic, but not so big of a fan of Windows.
Yeah.
And really wanted something like Visual Basic, but for the Mac. I looked at HyperCard, and I worked with HyperCard for a while, but that wasn't quite what I was looking for. And one day I stumbled across Cross Basic, which was a shareware product at the time. And I thought, you know, I took a look at it. It was very, very rough. Needed a lot of work and a lot of polish, but I could see its potential. So I contacted the author, Andrew Berry, and asked him what his plans were. And at the time, he was actually a Windows programmer. he did Mac stuff on the weekends, you know, and at night just as his hobby, and didn't really have much in the way of plans for Cross Basic. Matter of fact, here's a little factoid. The software he was working on for a living was software that was being used by the judges in the Oklahoma City bombing trial.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he was working on that, and I asked him what his plans were. He didn't really have any plans, and I asked him if he wanted to work on Cross Basic for a living. And he said he did. So I said, okay, well, I'm going to go write up a business plan and raise some money, and I'll get back to you.
Just at the drop of a hat, you just liked the application, and you thought, I like to do this for a living.
Yeah, well, because what I thought was, first of all, for a long time, I really wanted to run a development tools company. But I have to be honest and say that I never really expected that would happen. It just seemed like starting from scratch, and development tools is an incredibly difficult business.
A lot of competition as well, especially back then.
Well, it's competition plus... platform vendors tend to use tools to promote their platform, which often means that they'll give them away for free. So you're competing with free. And so you really have to have something pretty darn compelling and unique to do well in development tools. But my opportunity presented itself, and I said, you know, this is it. This is my opportunity, so I've got to make it happen. And that was in late 1997.
Well, really, that's not that long ago.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, it's more than 10 years ago.
You said you started kind of with HyperCard as far as the Mac programming goes. Do you see a lot of people programming now that got their start with HyperCard?
Yeah, a lot. Our users definitely, I hear about HyperCard. We're a multi-platform product now, so of course we're getting a lot of people who started with Visual Basic coming to Real Basic. But on the Mac side, HyperCard, some of them now with Java. Maybe they took Java in high school or college. But yeah, HyperCard is definitely there. And a lot of, believe it or not, still people with Basic. You know, people forget that Microsoft used to ship a Basic for the Mac.
That's how you programmed for the Mac originally.
Yeah, a million years ago.
Did it take? Go ahead, David.
That was one question I wanted to ask you, Jeff. I mean, why stick with Basic? I mean, it's not. It's often seen as not particularly trendy anymore. You know, most people, would say that the best language developing is something like C++. So, what is it about Basic that you think is worth sticking with and is worth developing your products on?
Okay, well, first of all, let me say that this particular our version of Basic is not your grandfather's Basic at all. And a lot of people hear the name Real Basic and they say, oh, well, Basic, you know, line numbers interpreted, that's what they think it is. Our version of Basic is actually fully object-oriented. It was developed as an object-oriented Basic from the beginning. There's no line numbers. There's no interpreter. It's compiled to machine code. We build native executables on all platforms. We use native controls. So in terms of the power of it, it's an extremely powerful language and development environment. We rarely, if ever, get a customer saying, gee, I just couldn't figure out a way to develop my solution with your product. Now, the advantages of Basic is that with Basic, I think there's a sweet spot. You know, we eliminate a lot of the complexity and keep most of the power, so that it's a very easy to learn product, and people get into it very, very quickly. You think about C++, and whether you're programming with maybe with Code Warrior in the old days on the Mac or today with Xcode, there's a mountain of stuff you have to learn. To do anything interesting. Whereas with Real Basic, I mean, you know, you launch Real Basic and there's a window in front of you and you drag some controls on it and you press run and there it is. You've got an interface. Yeah. And you go back and double click on a control and type in some code and it works. And you can learn incrementally. It's like climbing a foothill before you climb a mountain. Whereas with C++, it's like climbing the mountain first.
That's right, yeah. Okay.
I was looking on your website, and you had those little videos, more like PR videos than tutorials.
Yeah.
But it really gave me an understanding of what it is that Real Basic is about. And so those are really cool.
Well, good.
If anybody listening wants to see Real Basic in action, go to realsoftware.com, and you'll see the videos there. Those are pretty cool.
And that's exactly the point of those videos is for you to get a taste for what the environment is like to work in. It's literally like if you were at a trade show and we were going to give you a demo, what would we demonstrate? Well, that's what those are for.
Yeah, one thing I really liked about that was that you have those videos in all three platforms that Real Basic works in.
Uh-huh. And that's a lot of work. But I'm glad you like them.
So Real Software started in 1997. How did you get started? I mean, how did you write the business plan and compare it to how long it was before you actually had a shipping product?
Well, I wrote the business plan in late 97. It was probably about, I guess it was around October, and September, October. And we shipped version one of Real Basic on July 4th, actually, of 1998 at Macworld New York. So that was about 7 or 8 months, something like that.
Yeah.
There was no documentation at the time, so we had to write documentation to ship the first version. We had to build a website. We had to polish the product. There was a lot.
And it was just the two of you?
No, there was actually, at the time we shipped, there was four of us.
Okay.
Yeah, so we had because I already had a consulting business when we got started. We just, when we decided to do this, we were going to shut down the consulting business and focus on this product entirely. But in terms of, you know, it was actually tough, because if you think back to 1997, 1998, that was really the height of the internet boom. And
yeah.
At that time, it was also when, you know, we were going to have Java running on our toasters, right? I mean,
yes, absolutely.
So,
yeah.
So I'm trying to pitch a product that really has nothing to do with the internet and has nothing to do with Java. And Sun is claiming that Java is going to be the cross-platform holy grail. So getting people interested in investing in the company was a challenge, to say the least. Plus, I didn't know very much about investing at the time. So when a cousin of mine, who at the time was a Silicon Valley CEO, I talked to her about venture capital, and she said, well, if you don't have a business plan that needs at least $2 million, they're not going to be interested. And I was so naive. I was like, how the hell am I going to spend $2 million?
That's crazy.
So that probably worked to my advantage, because I ended up launching the business mostly on friends and family money.
How do you approach them with that? How do you come to them and say, this is the business plan, this is what we like to do, give us some of your 401k money?
Well, you start by getting down on your knees. I just told them, you know, why I thought the product was a good thing, why I thought it was a good investment. And most of them are people who know me very, very well, know me a long time, either in business or personally. And I think for the most part, they were betting on me more than on their understanding of the technology. Some of them understood the technology, understood that the Mac needed this kind of product. But for many of them, they just said, if he believes it, then I'm going to invest in it, which was, that's a great feeling.
Oh, absolutely. How difficult is it to support a cross-platform compatibility in your software?
Boy, it is a lot of work. A lot of people have tried it and not done very well. If you look at applications written in Java, for example, on the desktop, they're really, really horrible. So it's a lot of work. We have to the platforms are in constant motion, and building a development tool is nothing like building any other kind of application. For example, this is one of these technical details that a lot of people don't know about the Mac, but there's two formats for an application on the Mac. There's PEF, which is the format from the old days of classic Mac OS, and then there's MacO, which is the file format for applications on the native applications on Mac OS X. Well, most people don't need to know anything about that, don't care. Most programmers don't need to know anything about that and don't care, because the development tool handles that for them, like Xcode, for example. Well, we needed to know that, because we need to be able to build applications. And Apple doesn't provide any documentation on the MacO format, because who would need to know about it, right?
Right.
And for example, to support MacO, we had to send engineers to Apple with our source code and have them sit down next to engineers at Apple and figure out how to make it work. We had the same issue when Apple switched to the Intel processor, because for all the same reasons, the average developer doesn't need to know about that stuff, because the development tool that they're using takes care of those kind of things for them.
Yeah.
So,
but unfortunately, you are the development.
Exactly.
Oh.
So, it's a bigger challenge for us.
What's it like working with Apple? I mean, are they pretty accommodating, or is it like pulling teeth with them?
Well, it's both. Sometimes they're very accommodating, and sometimes it's like pulling teeth. I think it's sort of like going to the dentist. Some days they say, boy, everything looks great. All we need to do is polish your teeth and off you go. And other days they've got bad news for you.
Yeah,
and how does it? I mean, I presume you have to have the same sort of relationship with Microsoft for the Windows platform. So, I mean, how does that work? Because obviously, you've got a product that's actually in direct competition with something they're selling. Because
yeah.
They have Visual Studio, which has Visual Basic in it.
Yeah, we don't have much of a relationship with the Windows side of Microsoft. But the good news is the development community is so large that we kind of almost go unnoticed. They provide so much information that we don't often have to deal with Microsoft on a on the Windows side. Though we do have contacts on the Windows side, and they've They've been encouraging us to support .NET, but I haven't heard a compelling argument yet to do that.
Yeah.
And I'm being completely honest with you there. I just haven't.
No, you're not the first person I've heard that from.
Yeah,
As somebody who knows Visual Basic, I mean, I look at the .NET version of it, and it just it makes my head ache. It really does.
Well, I will tell you this. Most schools, we certainly have a lot of customers that are school districts that buy Real Basic to teach programming. In fact, our largest customer, our largest single customer, is the Ministry of Education for the country of Poland. They've bought 10,000 Real Basic licenses. We're in 10% of the high schools, hopefully 100% at some point. But anyway, we're in 10% of the high schools over there, and they replaced Visual Basic with Real Basic. And what we often hear is that, you know, despite the fact that they can get Visual Basic for free, they would rather teach with Real Basic because what they hear is that the kids don't like Visual Basic. They don't like Visual Studio. They find it too overwhelming, too complex. Whereas when they use Real Basic, they can get started quickly and make some progress, learn a little bit more, make some more progress. It's that incremental approach, I think, that works really well.
I mean, there's something I noticed very much about your development environment from looking at it. You know, I had a look at it this week to prepare for this discussion, and the first thing I noticed when I first fired it up is how easy and how intuitive the development environment you've created for creating your programs is, and how all the documentation is. It's not in your face, but it's there available as you start using the products, whereas with Microsoft Visual Studio, it's not. You know, it's all in separate files and separate windows, and everything is self-referential. So unless you've got the whole help file open in front of you, it's really hard work trying to figure out what's going on. Whereas with your documentation, the way that your IDE works is, in fact, everything, it kind of flows very easily. I was quite impressed with that.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Now, your program also works with Linux as well, correct?
Yes, it does. We support Mac, Windows, and Linux.
So do you get a lot of support from the Linux community?
We do, but the Linux community is, you know, it's hard to define what that means when you say the Linux community. It's kind of all over the place.
I'm referring more towards the open source guys.
Well, we're closed source, so the open source people often are not big fans. On the other hand, there isn't a product like ours really on Linux, so we get some positive support in that respect.
How many people are working at Real Software today?
A lot.
A lot. So it's not just a small company anymore by any means.
We don't disclose. We're a privately held company, so we don't disclose revenue and employees, things like that. But I'll say this, we're a global company. We have people in, France, Italy, Germany, China.
Poland?
Not in Poland, actually. The customers in Poland.
Yeah.
But Japan, et cetera. So,
I've learned a lot about software that I never would have heard, mostly because I get a lot of PR from Real Software announcing new products that's built with your software.
Uh-huh.
How does that work? Do you guys work closely with the developers so when they develop something, you help promote it for them?
Yeah.
Or is that some kind of an agreement?
It's not exactly an agreement. When people who have written something in Real Basic contact us, we make sure our community knows that we have a fairly large press reference list and that we can help them get more press than they might get if they were trying to do it on their own. So they contact us and they work with our marketing department to get their press releases ready because oftentimes, they're writing them themselves and they don't have the background in writing press releases. So we'll give them some help and we'll send it out to our press contacts, hopefully to get them more coverage than they would have gotten otherwise.
Well, I could tell you it works from a firsthand experience.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
Real recently released a SQL server. Did you see a market for an SQL database in that sphere that was not being fulfilled by the open source community, or is Real Basic SQL Server more about supporting real applications on the server side?
Yeah, so it's a couple of things. First and foremost, I think that what we do at Real Software, and I think it's something we do better than almost any company around, is we take complex and powerful things and make them easy and accessible, but keeping the power there. Well, one of the things that's happened as a result of that is a lot of our users build database applications, and then they'd have to use some other database, you know, some, so they'd have to choose some database backend, whether it was a commercial product or an open source product. And what they told us is they really wanted to buy the complete solution from us. They wanted something that's tightly integrated. They wanted to get one source for support. When there was an issue, they wanted to make sure that, you know, they could have one party to talk to. And what we found is that with a lot of the database servers out there, they're either expensive or complex to install. And Real SQL Server is just ridiculously easy to install. I mean, I could send it to you via email, and you can drag it onto the desktop and launch it. Wow. Whereas, you know, MySQL and Postgres and Oracle, especially Oracle, and other databases, they're really not designed for ease of installation.
No, I can verify that, because we're running MySQL at mymac.com. That's what's serving up our database.
Yeah.
And I don't understand a darn thing about it, to be honest. I've looked at it, and I just shake my head and go, I'm not messing with that stuff. I'll hire someone, because it's over my head. Would your solution be a better solution for me?
It could be. You should take a look at it. We support PHP, so if your website's using PHP to talk to MySQL,
yep,
then we have support for that. So that's definitely a possibility. The other thing about Real SQL Server is, you know, we have a lot of customers that are building commercial software that use a database backend. And what we found is a lot of people have misconceptions about MySQL. They think that MySQL is free. And MySQL actually is not free if you're building a commercial application. You're supposed to buy a license,
right,
for MySQL Enterprise. And so that's a differentiator. We have some pretty good licensing. The other thing is, we have a built-in database engine, and we wanted to have a server that used the same engine so that when someone built a single-user database product, they could then easily, you know, take the database file, move it over to a server, point their application at the server, and now they've got multi-user. So that was another.
Would it be easy? How's migration work? Is that pretty easy for someone like me with a site like mymac.com that's got, you know, I don't know, a lot of pages, a lot of users, a lot of, you know, just the complexity of an entire site. How's the migration going from that to your product?
I don't think I haven't done that kind of migration myself personally, but I don't think the migration would be that big of a deal. I mean, it's mostly going to be just moving the data over from MySQL, you know, exporting to a bunch of files and importing into our product, and then you know, probably some minor changes to your code. But SQL, the good news about SQL is that it is a standard, so there shouldn't be too many differences between MySQL and Real SQL Server. But I will say that the main benefit and the main reason we developed it is for use with Real Basic.
Gotcha. This March, Real will host its fifth annual Real World Software User Conference in Austin,
mm-hmm,
Texas. What's this conference focus on, and is it real popular? A lot of people show up for this?
Yeah, it's mostly a learning event. We have all kinds of different courses, sessions from, you know, beginning Real Basic for people that are just getting started, all the way up to very advanced sessions. Like we do a session on the internals of our compiler, and that session's conducted by the guy that writes our compiler. And we were just talking about this the other day, and we're saying that, you know, it's not so much that people attend that particular session because they'll change the way they write their code. I think people are just really curious about how it works. And
so this could be for complete newbies as well. If somebody was interested in learning how to use Real Basic and writing software for whatever platform that they want to write it for, this would be a conference that they could come to and actually learn how to use the software?
Absolutely. We have a complete beginner track. It would be a great way to do that. It's a great way to meet people that are using the product. It's a great chance to interact with us at Real Software. And it also happens to be right around South by Southwest. So if you're ever a fan of coming to the South by Southwest Music and Media Conference, it just worked out this year that we're right up against that. So
you can go from one
exactly
to the other. Now, your user forums, they always seem pretty busy. I've been looking at them for the last week. You got thousands of posts, a lot of replies. Mm-hmm. It's a real community. Oh, yeah. Does Real Software, are you guys active in the forums as well? You know, answering, maybe posting questions of your own? How active are you in your forums?
We're pretty active. We haven't been as active lately because we've been kind of heads down in development. But we often have our engineers answering questions on the forums. And that's not an uncommon thing at all. And yeah, the community is very, very active. We also have a couple of mailing lists as well. We have some users that prefer mailing lists to online forums. So.
Awesome. Do you have a question, David?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned before about you know, often a manufacturer will offer their development tools for free. I mean, obviously, Apple does that with Xcode. Xcode's available on every OS X CD, DVD. And obviously, there's Apple Script, there's Automator, there's all sorts of programming services built into the Mac operating system nowadays. I mean, how do you see Real Basic as a complement to those facilities or as a competitor? I mean, how do you see where you fit within that space?
Well, I'll say this. I think we take up a different space. What we find is that, you know, there are those people who maybe came from a C++ background and using Xcode or, writing in Objective-C, learning all the Cocoa APIs and all that, you know, that they're comfortable doing that. But yeah. if you think of people and their kind of how much they want to learn to get something done, if you imagine that sort of as a pyramid, those kind of people are at the top of the pyramid. You know, they're a tiny fraction of the users. And, I mean, I taught myself C and the classic macOS APIs back before macOS 10. And, man, that was a lot of work to make anything happen. So yeah. There are those people that, and I think there's a lot more people, who they want to build software, they've got great ideas, but they don't want to, you know, they don't want to climb a mountain in order to do it. And yeah. That's what appeals to them with Real Basic. That's how we appeal to them. You know, we get customers that tried Xcode and or tried Visual Studio or tried Java, and they just felt like it was too hard, too complex. And they try Real Basic, and they find out that they can do it. You know, we have customers. Oh, go ahead.
So, well, yeah, I mean, I was just going to say as well. Not only that, but you can develop in your environment on a Mac, and then you can actually deploy that application to a PC.
Right.
You can compile direct for the PC.
Yeah, and that is definitely our biggest unique selling point, is that if you need something to be cross-platform, there are really not many other choices for building a cross-platform application. Visual Studio is not a choice. Xcode's not a choice. Eclipse really isn't a choice. So if you want something cross-platform, that's where that's the biggest reason why people come to us. That and, you know, ease of use are the biggest reasons.
Okay.
Let's get back to you for a minute, Jeff. If, God forbid, Steve Jobs was hit by a bus tomorrow and your name as a successor for the CEO position came up and the Apple's board of directors wanted to meet you and talk about taking over, would you be interested? And if so, what kind of changes would you make to Apple?
Well, I guess that would depend on whether they're buying lunch.
Of course.
I think that Apple is doing a great job, obviously. They're doing better than they've ever done. You know, I can't argue with that. I will freely admit that I'm a shareholder, so I'm pretty happy with their stock long term.
Although it did take a hit recently.
It did take a hit, and I should have seen that coming. But that's okay. I invest in them for the long term.
You bought them at 12,
not
right?
Quite 12. I bought it about 14. Actually.
Oh, so yeah, you're doing great.
Okay. Yeah. I also invested in Pixar and was real happy with that investment as well.
So you're a fan of Steve Jobs.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the results, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Of the results.
Would you want to work for someone like him?
You know,
No, he's a CEO guy. He doesn't want to work for anybody.
He's an interesting. I've had brief chats with him, and I've learned a lot about him from other people. And like I said, I can't complain with what he's doing. He's definitely making it happen over at Apple. And I think that the thing that Apple is doing well is that Apple I mean, anyone who's going to succeed in Jobs has got a huge set of shoes to fill. And
tough road to follow.
Yeah, the thing that Apple, I think, is doing well is they're really good at finding the sweet spot with their products. You know, I think they aim, and we try to do this with Real Basic as well, and Real SQL Server. They really aim for 80% of their customers. You know, it's like, let's make the ideal product for 80% of our customers. Now, you might think, well, wait a minute, don't you want 100%? Not exactly, because if you aim for 100%, you're going to end up with a lot of
compromises.
Right, and feature creep. You're going to end up with a really complex, inelegant product that is probably not going to satisfy everybody or anybody at all. So I think what Apple does is they, for example, there are things that are missing from the iPhone that, you know, the average person doesn't need, so they're not there. So Apple, I think, is really good about their design, and I think they're good at knowing when to ship. You know, a lot of companies, technology companies, they over-engineer their products and they take forever to ship, and in some cases that's their downfall. There was the guy who writes the compiler here at Real Software. He was building a competing product back in the around 2000, 2001, before I hired him. And he was convinced that he was building a product that was better than our product, and we shipped.
There's a big difference
and
there,
and
isn't
now he's
there?
Working for us, and he's happy working for us because he was on his own, and we're a team, and that's a different
kind of environment,
different dynamic. But yeah, I think that the Apple, their design is really good. They occasionally make mistakes, and that's okay. Everybody does. But I think they learn from them, and we get better products as a result. And, you know, gosh, you can't really complain. Apple does a fantastic job.
Anything about Real Software that you want to tell us that most people don't know that I think the listeners may find interesting?
Well, that's a good question. I don't get asked that question very often. Well, mostly I would just say that if you've ever just had any thought about, you know, programming, or if you've ever, programming is kind of a means to an end. So if you've ever had an idea for something, you know, some piece of software that you thought would solve a problem for yourself or for other people, but you thought, you know, getting it developed is going to be too expensive, or I'll never be able to figure out programming, give Real Basic a try, because we have so many customers that started that way, and people that have built their own empires essentially based on software that's written in Real Basic. Oh, here's an interesting fact, actually, that your listeners might be interested in.
This is our Barbara Walters.
Yeah,
moment,
not exactly.
Right?
But it's as close as I'll get, I guess. So, you know, if you're a Mac user and you live within 500 miles of a Mac store or an Apple store, you've been in an Apple store, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So when you go to an Apple store, depending on the store, there's a theater, right? And if it's a big enough city, and you've got a bunch of Macs everywhere, and you've got demo software on all the Macs, and you've got music playing over the PA, well, all of that, the theater demos, the software that's on the machines, even the music playing over the PA system, that's all controlled from Apple headquarters in Cupertino, and it's all controlled with software written in Real Basic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, they have software on the HQ, and then they have software running in each of the stores, and it all they basically can actually shuffle the songs that are playing on the PA system. They can monkey with the software. There's no reliance on anyone locally for that. They want to control all that from headquarters, and it's all done with Real Basic. So there's a little bit piece of trivia.
Just one final question. You mentioned the iPhone a couple of minutes ago. Obviously, we're waiting to see the SDK that hopefully is going to come out this month. Can you see Real Basic supporting iPhone application development in the future?
It's certainly possible. I mean, if you think about what we do is cross-platform. And so right now, that means Mac, Windows, and Linux. But at some point in the future, that could also mean mobile applications and the web. Matter of fact, at Real World, we actually showed a few years ago a technology preview of building web applications in Real Basic. I'm anxious to see the SDK for the iPhone. The iPhone has got, I think I just saw an article the other day that said they had like 25% market share in the last couple of months or so. So they're obviously doing well. It's a great platform for delivering a mobile application because of the big screen. So we're very interested in looking at it. We were at Macworld in January, and we got a lot of questions about the iPhone. But the thing I told all of those that asked is that we haven't seen the SDK yet, so we don't know what it's going to be capable of. So we'll have to kind of wait and see. But I'd certainly like to see it happen.
Cool.
His name is Jeff Perlman. He is the CEO and founder of Real Software. If you guys want to learn more about Real Software, check him out at realsoftware.com. That's the end of our podcast this week. We'll be back next week. No guests next week. It's going to be Valentine's Day when we review or when we record the podcast. So it's just going to be a great big love fest for the Macintosh here. The week after that, we're going to have America Online on and talk about, believe it or not, their new Mac software that's coming out and a whole new focus for the online service. But, Jeff, I wanted to thank you for coming on this week. Really appreciate you taking the time and teaching us a little bit about Real Software. And I'm more interested in programming than I've ever been now. I'm still scared to death, but I think I'm going to actually give it a try.
Well, great. And thanks, Tim, David, and Guy. I really appreciate you having me on. This has been really enjoyable.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.